Welcome to Oncology Today, recent advances in the treatment of soft tissue sarcomas. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Mark Ogolnik from the City of Hope to discuss recent advances in this field. And in addition to this audio podcast, there's also a corresponding video program with Dr. Ogolnik's slide presentation. To begin, Dr. Ogolnik commented on the critical role of pathology evaluation in the management of these patients. As I was watching you go through all this, particularly all the new stuff, I was kind of wondering why we're not doing more CME in this area, because the incidence of this disease is not much different than, let's say, follicular lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell, myeloma.
So I think CME tends to be around the time that there are new drugs that have come to market, and that's the most exciting time for it. I do think that this is an area that sort of becomes a little bit of a black box when you talk about fellowships and the ability for fellows to be able to engage in true sarcoma programs. Every academic medical center essentially should have a sarcoma program and probably does. So in my world, like, so when someone comes into me and says, I have a rare tumor, have you ever seen this? The reality is I don't see breast cancer. And so as common as breast and prostate are, they're rare tumors to me. I create an entire career, and my colleagues do as well, where this becomes all that we see. And so as a rare tumor, there is such a plethora of patients out there. There are so many patients with so many rare histologies that are sort of trying to mobilize and figure out how to best be treated, where to best be treated, what clinical trials to go on. But anytime a CME wants to be done on a topic of sarcoma, you will find no shortage of academic medical oncologists that will jump at the opportunity to do it, because we really want to educate our patients and really educate the community to make sure that patients are appropriately treated. It's very hard to stay abreast of all the new drugs that come through. I have JCO on my desk every week. I have emails coming through every day. And it's just when I look, there are so many drugs and so much has changed in the landscape from when I finished my fellowship 15 years ago. It is impossible to stay on top of everything.
Yeah, and particularly, I think the classification kind of stumps a lot of people. How do you, you went through very elegantly a lot of the granularity of how we classify it. But from a clinical point of view, how do you think it through clinically, particularly from the perspective of the general medical oncologist? Can you talk broadly about what you think they are seeing and sort of what some of the messages are that they need to understand?
Correct. So I think that the starting point and the gateway for everything is going to be pathology. And so I think this holds true for everything in our field. And certainly as I was training, I remember all my hematology colleagues always discussing lymphoma and just making sure we have the right classification. So I think this is identical to the way we used to view that or still view that. We need the right classification for this. And so often I see patients coming in with pathology reports that are not in depth enough or with enough information to really truly give us the right histology. The grade of the tumor is so imperative. If we look at TMN classification right across the board and we look at staging of tumors, we have to remember to stage a sarcoma, you need a grade. And so when I see these reports come through and there is no grade of the tumor, well, then you really can't stage the tumor and you can't really give a prognosis to the patient. And so I think where the medical oncologist is often given a bad startup to a sarcoma patient is an inadequate pathology report. And I think it becomes very important that any pathology that is done needs to be reviewed at an outside institution from a pathologist that sees a high volume. And I think once they get these reports, and I see them, when I get these community practice oncologists send me patients, I do see a lot of these reports that are coming through from some of the major academic centers. And that gives them the ability to start treating the patients. These reports are phenomenal. If you read through some of the interpretations afterwards, the pathologist will give you a lot with respect to malignant potential, with respect to likelihood of recurrences. They put a lot of information in this. So you have to go beyond just reading that top line that gives the diagnosis. And if you read the body of the work, you will see the pathologists are putting a lot of effort for these second opinions in the community practices. And that will give these practices a leg up and an ability to really move forward and be able to make a profound impact for their patients. After you have a very clear pathology, then it becomes difficult. You really have to determine, is the patient surgically resectable, yes or no? You need to figure out, is the histology one that will benefit from any form of chemotherapy in that curative intent setting? You have to figure out who gets radiation. So it is complex, but you need to use your teammates around you. And so I don't make decisions about radiation. If I have any inkling that it may be beneficial, I send a radiation consult. Do I realize some patients don't need radiation? I still send the consult 100%. But my view is that if you educate the patient, they become a little bit more of an advocate for themselves. In the metastatic setting, I think you have to just lean into it. I think you have to be patient. I think you have to end up trying a lot of things before you come up with some of the best answers for a patient. I had a patient about 6 lines of therapy before I found the winner. There are winners out there. I think when I was taught many years ago in breast cancer, the likelihood of responding to the first treatment was highest. And as you go along therapies, the likelihood of responding is less. I don't think that holds true to sarcoma. So I do think you could find your winner as the fourth agent. And so I do think you have to instill hope for the patients. I think you have to be realistic, but you also have to make sure they realize that if one therapy or two do not work, the third one could work.
In the metastatic setting in general, in addition to expert pathology, what about genomic evaluation, NGS, or liquid assays? In what situation do you think that should be done? It seems like oncologists are doing that routinely in metastatic solid tumors in general. How about in sarcomas?
Correct. So routinely, I will send NGS platforms on every single metastatic patient. Every patient that will get a therapy, if someone walks in and their performance status is very poor, then obviously I'm going to save the money there because it's not going to change anything. But for every single patient, I said NGS. If we have some instances of bone sarcomas and you're not going to be able to draw the information you want from the bone, I will send off ctDNA for those patients. If there is a sample, so if it's someone that was treated 5 years ago for cure, 5 years later, they have widely metastatic disease. If the disease is not amenable to biopsy, and I'm convinced this is the same process, then I'll send off liquid because I'm not going to use a sample from several years ago. But for the most part, I will re-biopsy people as needed. I don't keep re-biopsying them as they go through. I send usually one NGS panel per patient. Where I get stuck sometimes is I tend to, if a patient doesn't realize that their primary oncologist did it, and I don't see it in the medical records that are sent to me, then sometimes I will repeat it in those situations, but I try very hard not to.
So again, I want to focus on metastatic disease, but you did mention ctDNA, and I am curious how useful that is in general with sarcomas and whether or not it's being looked at in localized disease setting in terms of adjuvant therapy, the way kind of it's being done right now with colon cancer.
Yeah, so in the localized disease, I have not seen much data for using it in order to be able to evaluate because there isn't much with respect to adjuvant therapy that we use. Where we do adjuvant therapy and where I do see a big role for this is actually in our GI stromal tumors. So for metastatic GI stromal tumors that you do the biopsy at the diagnosis of metastatic disease, you have the primary mutations. You're really never reevaluating to understand what these secondary and tertiary mutations become. And so as we look at where does sunitinib, regorafenib, and ripretinib fall with respect to what mutations do they best cover, and there is a lot of data for what mutations are better for which drug, it is reasonable to send off circulating tumor DNA at progression. And so instead of rebiopsying patients, if you send off the circulating tumor DNA, you potentially are picking up those secondary resistant mutations, and that will impact how you treat the patients. And so there is a big area for that in that area.
So why don't we try to drill into particularly management of metastatic disease and new agents? And I guess we can kind of start out with sort of traditional soft tissue sarcomas. Can you talk about sort of how you conceptualize them, at least in the metastatic setting, in terms of trying to develop a treatment plan, how you look at pathology and other factors and sort of figuring out what path they're going to take?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So for common things being common, the majority of soft tissue sarcomas are going to fall into an area that are going to be responsive or appropriately treated with chemotherapy. And for the majority of the soft tissue sarcomas, we're going to go with doxorubicin-based therapy as the first-line therapy. And so there are very few instances where you're not going to proceed with a doxorubicin-based therapy. The ones where you potentially won't are going to be in those tumors that are exquisitely sensitive to the effects of perhaps ifosfamide. And so that would be like synovial sarcomas. We treat angiosarcomas very differently. And so there's a different pathway for those using paclitaxel instead of using a anthracycline-based therapy. And then for older patients, we might go the route of pazopanib as a first-line agent. But globally, if we think about what's coming into a general medical oncologist, common things being common, it's going to be leiomyosarcoma, liposarcoma, or undifferentiated, and taking it the route of an anthracycline does make sense. There are some nuances with liposarcomas because we really need to make sure we're pulling out the well-differentiated, potentially de-differentiated, because in those situations, we can look at the role of palbociclib because there's enough data to suggest that that would be an effective therapy for some patients, and therefore you bypass the need for all the toxicities associated with chemotherapy.
Palbociclib?
Yes.
As a single agent?
As a single agent.
And you see objective responses?
So objective response rate's quite low. Stabilization of disease and progression-free survival advantage is there. It's been presented a number of times at ASCO, at CTOS. There are publications. There are for several. There's for abemaciclib as well as palbociclib. There are studies looking at the others in the same class. But for well-differentiated liposarcoma, so this is your grade one tumors that are unlikely to respond to chemotherapy, unlikely to respond to radiation therapy, and therefore manipulating a different pathway in order to get control of the disease has really made an impact for patients. So these are often very large tumors. They're often recurrent tumors. They're intra-abdominal tumors. They often have one resection. They come back afterwards. And it sort of is one of these diseases that you just want to get control of before it causes any problems for patients. What's nice is it is listed in NCCN guidelines, so it is easy to get it from insurers, or you petition the drug companies, obviously, to see whether or not they'll be able to provide it for our patients.
So can you talk more about sequencing of therapy beyond doxorubicin approaches or chemotherapy approaches in the first line, and particularly what we know in terms of TKIs and targeted therapy?
So sequencing therapies, I think what becomes very important is to take into account that there's a patient behind everything that we're doing. And when you look at the patient, we don't want to continue to use all these toxic therapies all the time. And so I think pazopanib is a wonderful second-line agent for all soft tissue sarcomas except for liposarcoma. It is approved for them all. It is effective. Is it as good as some of the other agents? Well, every patient's going to respond a little bit differently, but the side effect profile and the ability for patients to sustain work schedules and have fewer appointments, it certainly is very good for patients from a quality of life standpoint. If it didn't work, and you would see that within the first 2 to 3 months, then you could go to other chemotherapies. Or if you feel like you have to have a very robust response, you may want some of the other chemotherapies that have a higher response rate. So we still are looking at our gemcitabine and docetaxel. We still are looking at trabectedin for liposarcoma, for leiomyosarcoma. Very good drug for myxoid liposarcoma. That group, if you tease out the curves and if you look at the plots specifically for myxoid lipo, they really do have a really nice progression-free survival that probably is almost 6 months. It doesn't work as well for the de-differentiated lipo or the well-differentiated, certainly, but for the myxoid lipo, it is certainly a very good drug. You have the use of temozolomide as an oral agent that certainly is going to be tolerable for patients. I had mentioned, and I did a slide about this because I really feel that because it doesn't have an FDA indication, regorafenib is not as commonly used for patients with soft tissue sarcomas, but there is enough data to suggest that it is effective. There is data also, phase two data, looking at cabozantinib for select patients with some bone sarcomas. And so that certainly is something that people should consider. And so I do think the targeted therapies tend to be easier to tolerate. They tend to provide flexibility for the patient, fewer appointments, much easier from a lifestyle standpoint. If people have kids, if people have jobs they want, then it certainly makes it easier for them.
So you have a great table that summarizes a lot of this, but getting back to regorafenib, I'm kind of curious what your experience is and what your experience is with toxicity. There's lots and lots of discussions we've had in colon cancer about dosing of regorafenib, and they've done trials on that and a lot of issues about hand-foot syndrome. What do you see? How do you approach it with sarcomas?
Correct. So no different. Our sarcoma patients are the same as every other patient. It is a difficult drug at the FDA-approved dosing schedule, in my opinion. And so I do find it difficult to start someone at 160 milligrams daily for 21 days of a 28-day cycle. What I tend to do is I tend to start them lower and ramp them up. If they're older, I'll start them at 80 milligrams and ramp up. I do have some colleagues that have used 80 milligrams continuous and haven't taken that week off and sort of have found that that's an easier regimen for the GIST patients. For the soft tissue sarcoma patients, for the right patient, I will start them at 80. I will tell them at a week or two later if they're doing well to go up to 120. If they're doing well at 120, they'll take a week off and then the next cycle start at 120 and then go up to 160 if they're able to tolerate it. We do communicate with them quite frequently. We've had discussions around the GIST patients over the years about how best to do this. And without a doubt, if you get a group of medical oncologists who treat sarcoma around a table and you say, how do you effectively keep someone on regorafenib? It involves using our nurses, using our pharmacists, using our mid-level providers, and calling the patients weekly, so that you treat the symptoms and the side effects of therapy very quickly so that you are able to maintain the patients on it. And so it does take a little bit more effort and a little bit more work. But if you bring them in weekly or bring the patients or call them weekly, it certainly will assist with being able to get dose intensity.
So a couple other items on your list in terms of new agents. I was kind of surprised to see tazemetostat there. Of course, we talk about that a lot in our lymphoma series, really interesting, the EZH2 inhibitor. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about that in soft tissue sarcomas?
Yeah, wonderful. So tazemetostat was used in somewhat of a basket trial, but not so much basket. It was a trial that had about six arms to the trial, and the arms included the epithelioid sarcomas. There was a synovial sarcoma arm. There was a rhabdo arm. And then there was other arms that include other tumors that were INI1 negative or deficient, SMARCB1. And so what we saw is presented at ASCO, as well as at our Connective Tissue Oncology Society, is specifically tazemetostat with the group of epithelioid sarcoma, which I think was the fifth cohort. It has since been published, and the FDA has given an accelerated approval for the drug as it confirms the appropriateness with a phase 3 trial that is predominantly being done overseas. But the drug was able to have disease control rate of about 51% for patients with these epithelioid sarcomas. And so while this tumor type is quite rare, the ability to control it, when we saw that there wasn't an ability to control this disease with chemotherapy, is quite encouraging. These tend to be younger patients. These tend to be tumors of the extremities. And so this is a generally well-tolerated drug that can be utilized for these patients. So there was a phase 1 study using the drug with doxorubicin. It is moving into phase 3, and the majority will be done overseas because as the drug is already FDA approved, the majority of patients with this condition already would have access to it.
You know, in lymphoma, it's approved. They do the EZH2 assay, but it's approved whether it's high or low, and it actually works better when it's positive, but people have been using it both. Do you actually do EZH2 assays with sarcomas?
So with sarcomas, we have not, but for this condition, you wouldn't need to do the EZH2, and you would just be able to use it based on the histology alone.
Anything you want to say about the available TREC drugs, and how often you see this with sarcomas, what your experience is? Have you had any patients that you've treated?
Yeah, so I think without a doubt, any of us who have seen a patient who has an NTRK fusion will say that the ability to treat the patient with an inhibitor has completely just enamored us, I would say is the best word for it. So these drugs are highly, highly effective. Finding these patients, I've told my patients before, when I find it, go buy a lottery ticket because the likelihood of finding it is so rare. Like there is something just so exciting. And so in my practice, probably once every 2 years, and I'm testing a lot of patients, maybe once every 18 months. But when you get the patients on these drugs, the effectiveness of these drugs are quoted at over 80%. The ability to control, the ability to tolerate these drugs, the patients just have had such a profound improvement. And really what you have to think is, so when I see someone with metastatic disease, I'm not going to wait for the NGS report to come back because it could be several weeks. I usually start them on first-line therapy because in my mind, the NGS report is only going to alter therapy in about 2% of patients. And so if I have someone on a primary chemotherapy and then the NTRK fusion comes back, I obviously take them off the chemotherapy, put them on the NTRK fusion. And so to give someone an anthracycline-based chemotherapy, then give them this drug, without a doubt, there's going to be such a profound difference from a quality of life standpoint. But if you're that patient and you're that unicorn, it is just profoundly important to get them on these drugs. I saw a patient who had an NTRK fusion on a report, was on third line therapy. The medical oncologist didn't realize the importance of the fusion. And to see a patient that has gone through three lines of therapy, progressed on each line, because they didn't have an understanding of the report, was very difficult to see.
Wow.
And so you will have NTRK 1 and 3 fusions are the most common. You can see these fusions in GIST as well, very unlikely, but you can see them as well. And I think from the preliminary data, I think response rates for the sarcoma was very high. And so these drugs are highly, highly effective.
So I know we have larotrectinib and entrectinib and also others. I know there's selitrectinib that's being looked at. Any difference that we've seen in any of these agents, or are they basically very similar in terms of toxicity and efficacy?
So my understanding is between larotrectinib and entrectinib, there's also the ROS1 inhibition of entrectinib. In my practice, I have traditionally used larotrectinib. It's just because it was the first one to market, and that was what I was most familiar with. I will say, and what I said before, is it's very important that if the patient does progress on one of these drugs, to get them on a clinical trial of second-line agents. And so there are some second-line agents used in this landscape that are looking to overcome the resistance attributed to the initial drugs. And I think given the low number of patients and the number of studies, if we're going to make headway in the field, we are going to have to divert those patients to clinical trials. And so I did recently have one who progressed after about a year and then did go on a second-line agent. And so they are out there and the second-line therapies are available. They are looking to make improvements along the first-line therapies.
Let's talk a little bit about GIST. I loved your algorithm slide. It kind of looks like non-small cell lung cancer is so complicated. Maybe we can start with a case and start that way. You have a patient here, a 62-year-old woman.
So I have been following this woman for a long time. And so this is a 62-year-old woman who first presented in 2007. She presented with persistent right upper quadrant pain. She had a CT scan done at the time in an emergency room. She was found to have a 9-centimeter gastric mass. She had a surgical resection in 2007 of this 9-centimeter GIST with 40 out of 50 mitoses per high-powered field. And exon 11 was detected, which would be the most common. So back in 2007, there was no approval of imatinib in the adjuvant setting. So she did go on one of these clinical trials. And the clinical trial she went on was 1 year versus placebo. And she did get 1 year of adjuvant imatinib at that time. And that was in October of 2007. By 2009, she had now been off for 1 year and liver lesions were noted on routine imaging. And we biopsied this to confirm metastatic disease and restarted her back on imatinib in November of 2009. So 2 years later, she had progression of disease. At that point, my practice was to increase imatinib to 800 milligrams per day. Now, looking back at a lot of this data, unless someone has an exon 9 mutation, I tend not to increase their imatinib to 800 milligrams. Some of the early data did suggest that a subset of patients, maybe a third, will derive benefit at the higher dose, but that probably is more restricted to the exon 9 mutated patients. So after that, she was switched over to sunitinib. The average patient is getting about 6 months on sunitinib. She's obviously not average because she was on that from July of 2011 till April of 2014. At that point, she went on regorafenib. Again, regorafenib is giving the average patient only a few months of progression-free survival advantage. And so she was one who was deriving a lot more. And she stayed on this for 4.5 years. And the dosing she was on at the end was only 80 milligrams every day, but I did give her a week off every 3 weeks. And her biggest side effect, it was calluses on the bottom of her foot from the drug. So after these three drugs, there were no other drugs FDA approved back in 2018. So that's when we started cycling through some of the other drugs. So she was on pazopanib briefly, and then I put through a single patient compassionate use protocol to the FDA in order to get her avapritinib, which we were able to get, and she did end up being on it for over a year. And then in May of 2020, ripretinib came to market. She had progressed in June of 2020. And so by June 21st, we put her on ripretinib. And then she did have some alopecia with it, which is a concern that patients have with ripretinib, is that they do get hair loss whereby they didn't have it with the other tyrosine kinase inhibitor. But otherwise, energy level is improved on the treatment. Mental status was unchanged. And so avapritinib could have some mental status changes associated with it. She didn't have that per se. but she did have marked improvement in pain. She was using pain medications with reduced use and really was only complaining of some alteration of diarrhea and constipation. And then I just saw her back in January of this year with a CT scan of her chest, abdomen, and pelvis. She remains on ripretinib and she has stable disease and is doing very nicely. Otherwise, she had a past medical history looking at GERD, hypertension, osteoporosis, hypothyroidism. She was working when I first met her. She has since retired. She's been able to survive long enough to see two grandchildren being born. At progression, I'll look for clinical trials, but also at that point, I would consider either some of these other tyrosine kinase inhibitors off-label.
So it sounds like ER-positive metastatic breast cancer, but I'm just curious how typical or atypical her course is. Going so long with metastatic disease?
Yeah, so I think what was most impressive a few years ago at ASCO, there was a republication of the initial patients that went through on imatinib, and you really saw a subset of patients, over 10%, were still around over 10 years later. And so I do think that this is a disease that can be categorized, in my mind, as a chronic condition that always will need treatment. When someone with this history here with hypothyroidism, hypertension, and asks me how long they're going to need to be on these drugs, what I typically will ask them when they started their drugs for hypothyroidism, for hypertension, did they ask the same question to their doctor? And the reason I ask this of them is really to get them to reframe the way they think about these diseases. We're not talking about a six-month survival. We're talking about some patients, a substantial number of patients that will sort of be on that edge of the curve that will do better than everyone else. And I have countless number of these patients with GIST who really continue to do well. And so I want them to frame it as a chronic condition, the same way they would view their hypertension, their diabetes, their hypothyroidism, and things like that.
I was really fascinated by what you were saying towards the end of your presentation about desmoid tumors. And I'm curious about this new agent you were talking about, nirogacestat. Have you had any patient receive that incidentally?
So I have not had any patient receive that. I've had patients receive other gamma secretase inhibitors, but not that drug.
What's a typical scenario that you might see or an oncologist would see a patient with a desmoid tumor? You kind of reviewed the kind of global spectrum of what you see clinically. What would a typical scenario be that an oncologist would end up seeing a patient like this?
Yeah, so I think most of the times, and I think most community practices will have tumor boards. So I think it's very important to capture these when they get presented by the surgeons at tumor boards. I think there is a lot of information about there that surgeons will continue to take these patients to surgery. And it is our practice that surgery is really doesn't have a big role in the treatment of patients anymore. And we certainly know that if patients go to surgery, the likelihood of recurrence is over 50%, if not higher. And often these will regress on their own. So for me in my practice, the first thing I have to do is try to make sure that the patients come into the clinic, because if you don't see them come in the clinic, you can't really help them work this out. So for me, I want to see what's happening with this tumor. I'd love to see a scan and then 6 months later, another scan. If I could only get one scan, then 3 months later, I rescan them. What I want to show them is that the disease is not growing. So I think what happens is someone has some abnormality, a desmoid is discovered, and then there is this, I need to take it out. Well, it is a benign condition, so it's important that they see this. And most patients who I see for the first time, I show them this slide and I focus on the placebo. And I really focus on the placebo because there is a subset of patients who don't need to be treated. And the worst thing we could do for our patients is put them through therapies that they don't need. And so really, I show them that there are tumors that will regress on their own. They'll have near complete responses on their own. And therefore, what I want to do is have a 3-month scan or 6-month scan to see whether or not the tumor is growing. I will never start a patient on treatment unless they are symptomatic or progressive. Progressive for me is growth of more than 20% over a 6-month period. In some clinical trials, we're using over a year period, but really between that 6 and 12 months, you want to make sure that it's an active tumor and not just something that is just dormant and sitting there. If it's dormant, we're not going to make any headway, or the headway we're making could be no different than placebo. But if you have progressive refractory to other therapies because they were progressive or symptomatic disease, you really do want to get them on a therapy. Historically, off of a clinical trial, we would use sorafenib. Now, with all the clinical trials we have looking at the Notch pathway and gamma secretase inhibitors, you really do want to get them on one of these drugs or wait for one of these drugs to come to market. And the first one likely to come to market is going to be this drug.
So I was really shocked when I saw the waterfall plot there for the placebo group. What is the biologic explanation for why you see these spontaneous regressions? And what have we learned about the biology of the process to start with? It's such an unusual scenario.
So it is very unusual. So we do know that these are tumors that sort of demograph a little bit more to women versus men. And so they are often, we see growth during times of pregnancy. And so whether or not some of this is really dependent on estrogen and whether or not estrogen is making these grow, these are benign conditions. And so there is the ability for them to regress on their own. There's great data for this ability to regress. And so really what we want to make sure is that the right patient is being treated. But there are a lot of fluctuations and depending on the age, depending on when we see them. And so if you had someone pregnant and the tumor started to grow because of all that estrogen surges, the moment the pregnancy was delivered and then the estrogen goes down, you would anticipate that these would regress. At times of menopause, we see regression as well. And so this is likely driven by factors in the body, and factors in the body change over time.
So this agent, nirogacestat, I don't know my simplified understanding of pathways. When I saw that word notch, I was thinking about hedgehog inhibitors. Is that the same sort of arena here or no?
The gamma secretase will cleave something intracellular in notch. The pathway will become altered to the sense that these tumors will start to regress. And certainly from the data, the phase two data, I mean, 100% of patients are deriving some benefit from this.
Yeah. The other thing is, what do we know in terms of tolerability? Any toxicity issues with this agent?
So the agent is very tolerable. And so what we have to see always is that we want to make it as easy as possible for these patients. It is a benign condition. So when we look at all the benefits of sorafenib, we certainly want to make sure that we're not inducing a lot of the side effects of sorafenib. The nice thing about the use of sorafenib in this, it's not used at a standard dose. It is used at half the standard dose that we use for other conditions. And so that does make it more tolerable. So if you have a little bit of hypertension, I think for patients, they'll be able to tolerate that. If you end up with hand foot, I think for a benign condition, it's very hard to tolerate something that's going to be that limiting. This drug is very well tolerated from my understanding from the phase two data. The phase three obviously will give us all the information, but there is certainly a lot of excitement within the community that this will be a great option for their patients. And having said that, there are other phase one or phase two clinical trials that are currently ongoing in the same space using the same mechanism of action. And so we may end up with two drugs instead of just one drug, which will certainly serve our patients well.
So you call it benign, but you also on your spectrum of desmoid have life-threatening out there or life-altering also. What is the typical presentation location and how often do you see it becoming a real potentially life-threatening problem and in what way? Local growth, I guess, huh?
Correct. Yeah. So I think what's interesting is, so I just had a discussion yesterday with my team here. We were looking at all the pathways we use in sarcomas, and they were asking me, they were showing me a pathway using methotrexate and vinblastine and saying, oh, you haven't used this in a while. Should we take it out? And I said, I haven't used it in a while, but I do use it about once every 5 years for a very aggressive desmoid. And so the last time I saw an aggressive desmoid, it was a woman in the ICU that was intubated because she had an intrathoracic desmoid that was affected her ability to breathe on her own.
Wow.
She did get a year of methotrexate and vinblastine. Last I saw her, that was over 6 years out from her intubation and hospitalization. She is still alive. And so there is a rare situation where these patients will derive benefit from cytotoxics. You could also use the anthracyclines for these patients. So I do it once every 5 years. Where I've done it is patients with usually familial desmoids. And so FAP patients who have the desmoids, and they tend to have a lot of intra-abdominal, they have multiple lesions, they are symptomatic, they risk bowel obstruction. And so once you start to get to those areas, the targeted therapies may not work fast enough. And so that's when you start on some of these chemotherapies, but I don't do it often, I must admit.
So interesting.
So in our practice, I may see one new desmoid a week. And so if you're thinking about all the desmoids that come through, I'm not doing this often at all.
You and your slides use the term that resembles out of control scar tissue. Is that your vision of what the pathophysiology sort of is?
So it usually is there's a disruption of some sort. And so certainly anytime there's a disruption or trauma, that certainly puts it at risk. And that's probably why we see it come back after surgery. That's probably the biggest trauma that we have in our body. And so that's how I sort of see this disruption of tissue that sort of starts to have an overgrowth and could cause problems for people. Before you ask me, where do we see it? We often see it intra-abdominally, but we certainly see it in the extremities, joints. And so certainly that becomes very disfiguring or difficult for patients. And so certainly will affect range of motion and other things like that. We have used radiation before for these. There are ablative therapies that can be used as well. So it really depends where the lesion is or where the tumor is and what you're trying to achieve.
So just a couple questions about some of the cases you have. We haven't talked much about checkpoint inhibitors. Curious in whether you see MSI high, how often you see it, have you ever treated them? I guess you have this patient who's 62-year-old with a mix of fibrosarcoma and a TMB of 888. That's pretty impressive. Was this patient MSI high?
So we did a case report on this last year and had it published. This is a 62-year-old patient who had 4 lines of therapy. So really classic therapy, really progressed quickly on almost all lines of therapy, except for maybe the pazopanib topotecan, where they were on it for 7 cycles. But then we put them on temozolomide and had 43 cycles. And so that's 43 months of stabilization before they had progression of disease and really improved at that. And so it was probably the use of the temozolomide that potentially did something internally that would add the tumor mutational burden to be so high. It was really something. We had tested the tumor very early on, and it was a new biopsy that had this. And so the initial biopsy did not have an elevated tumor mutational burden. And so the patient is currently stabilized with atezolizumab on a clinical trial. The only MSI patient that I put here is this 78-year-old female with a metastatic leiomyosarcoma who had several lines of therapy before a report was sent. And that showed MSI high, and the patient went on nivolumab and had a partial response and was doing great. I do have a second patient that has since presented in the practice that again is MSI high that I had figured out after 2 cycles of doxorubicin, and I took them off the doxorubicin and put them on immunotherapy. And so I certainly have used a lot of immunotherapy for patients, but it has to be for the right patient and certainly falling within where the data is available.
I was just sort of flashing on this patient with the TMB of 888. I wonder whether I was trying to think of where you would have a bunch of people who got temozolomide, I guess glioblastoma. I don't know. Has anybody ever looked what happens when you give temozolomide pre and post TMB?
So we looked at the data when we published the case report, and really what we were looking for is, did the temozolomide do any modulation to sort of allow for the uptake of this? And there was some data and there was some animal studies that we looked at that potentially would prove the point, and that's why we ended up publishing it. But I haven't looked at the GBM data per se.
That's really interesting. How about your 49-year-old man with the NTRK fusion? What happened there?
Yeah, so this is a patient who had 49 in August of 2019. He had left pneumonectomy for a 10-centimeter mass with the final path being an intimal sarcoma. He was given no adjuvant therapy at the time, which was appropriate. And then in November of 2019, ended up with a liver biopsy, which confirmed metastatic disease. And then he was put on first-line doxorubicin. And as he was on this first-line doxorubicin, we ended up sending off testing for this. And he quickly progressed on doxorubicin just around the time that we got the information that he was an NTRK3 fusion with ETV6. To my understanding, the partner of the fusion is not as relevant. And so really the relevant part here is that he's NTRK3 fusion and he went on larotrectinib. He still is having a partial response to therapy and he is on therapy for over a year now. And so, as I said, this is certainly a remarkable drug, very well tolerated in this patient. I can't think of any side effects that he had and makes him very functional.
Any tolerability issues with the larotrectinib?
Not in him. And then I've treated 2 other patients with it and I've had no tolerability issues, no dose reductions. In the original clinical trials, and if you pull the phase 1s and the phase 2s and combine them all together, which predominantly is what the company has done, there will be some toxicities associated, but not that many dose reductions. It's generally well tolerated. Interestingly enough, and I don't see pediatrics below 16, but it is probably one of the first drugs that I think I've seen that has been approved for both pediatric and adults at the same time. And so that's very important for our pediatric colleagues.
I was thinking your study where you looked at NGS in your patients, I was curious if you saw any BRCA alterations or HRD, theoretically, I guess if you test enough people, you'd find that. Have you seen that? And if you saw that, has anyone ever used PARP inhibitors? This comes up every now and then. You see a lung cancer patient who has BRCA, et cetera. What did you see there with the sarcoma patients?
I do have one patient with a chondrosarcoma that is currently on a PARP inhibitor based on a BRCA2 mutation. And then I also have a number of patients with salivary gland tumors, and I have treated those before with this based on those mutations as well.
Seen any objective responses?
Stabilization of disease, but no response.
Interesting.
In my limited number of patients.
Last thing I want to ask you is any sort of myths or misperceptions about sarcomas, anything you're seeing in second opinion that you maybe want to comment on, whether there's any sort of electronic second opinion thing in the Sarcoma Society? Is there any sort of organized way to sort of provide input to docs in practice also?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So the first one is easiest. The second one is becoming easier in the era of COVID. And so for the first part of the question, is there anything that there is misconceptions out there? So I think the number one misconception is that these are untreatable diseases. And it sort of bothers me a lot that I have to spend time when I see second opinions trying to go over some of the negativity that was brought into them when they originally saw their initial physicians, whether it be the surgeons or the medical oncologists, that sort of have told them that there are no effective therapies or no effective therapies beyond two lines of therapies. And we know that's not true. And so certainly there are a number of therapies for our patients, and our patients can do well. Not every patient will do well. The average life expectancy for a patient with metastatic disease is about 18 months. And so that isn't good enough. But that means 50% are living beyond 18 months. And I certainly would hope that anytime a patient is being sent for a second opinion, they're being sent for a second opinion because there is this realization that there are things out there that perhaps the referring doctor is unaware of. And certainly giving the patients the encouragement and the skills to go to these appointments, anticipating that they're going to hear something positive, is always, in my mind, a better way of approaching it than then coming in and telling me that they're told nothing works. With respect to second opinions and electronic and all of that stuff, I think in the era of telemedicine, it certainly is profound. Here at City of Hope, we certainly, all of us physicians, have a number of licenses across different states so that we're able to provide televideo consultations for patients. And so there are a number of patients that come. California is a big state. And so it certainly enables patients from Northern California to get opinions in Southern California. I still maintain licenses in other states. And so there's ability to do consultations for patients across the board. And so I've done them for other states throughout the United States. There's also those of us who have trained fellows, and fellows have gone throughout the United States. It's important that every medical oncologist sort of remembers who their sarcoma specialist was and just keep that number and just call someone. No one's ever going to not take a phone call. No one's ever going to not take an email. I teach every year at one of these board review courses. I give out my email at the end of it. And over the course of the year, I get emails. It takes me 10 minutes to respond to someone, to think about it, to be able to give them an answer. And that's 10 minutes that's invaluable for the patients. And so it's an easy thing to do. And so I think between televideo, between being able to access these second opinions, if your company provides access to any of these organizations that will do these second opinion documents that they'll supply to your oncologist, or just have your doctor pick up a phone, I think those are the easiest ways.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Ogolnik, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.